Hello and welcome to the Right to Vulnerable podcast. As truthful as resources permit, my name's Jimmy and I've been stuck in this house for 5 weeks now.
Yeah, I'm Jazza. Same thing. I've, more importantly, just realised that I am having 2.5 units more of alcohol a week than the NHS says I can. And I am appalled, not at my behaviour, but that the units of alcohol that we're expected to drink are so low.
Do you remember that Independent article that came out early on in the lockdown that suggested that the lockdown was the right time for us all to kick our alcohol habits?
Fuck off.
Yeah, that was pretty much Twitter's reaction.
Oh, kind of like there was this guy on Twitter who was like, I've lost 5 pounds, I've started learning a language, I've renovated my room, I've published a book, what have you done in lockdown? And I'm like, fuck off, mate. I've played Final Fantasy VII.
Well, that is something, I think.
It is. I'm very close to finishing it, and I've cried 3 times at the story already. I'm a 14-year-old boy again, Jimmy.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Jazza, what do we meet, albeit virtually, to do on this podcast?
Oh, sure. Sorry, thank you for prompting me. We meet... I am half a bottle of wine and a beer down.
Wine before beer.
Wine before beer, and you've got the fear. Oh, yeah, that's bad. Anyway, we talk sporadically about politics, social issues and current events, and also our experiences of being in lockdown, because what are we? We are a what are they called? Time vaults? Time capsules.
Yes, not time vaults.
Did you hear the story about the British Museum have started going around and collecting things from a time of COVID, like wedding disinvitations, face masks, Deliveroo vouchers, all of that kind of stuff.
Wow, that's quite tragic, but I imagine somebody will find that interesting in about 100 years' time.
I love that shit. I will go and see that exhibition tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yes. Obviously observing social distancing laws.
Well, that's very responsible of you, Jazza.
Thank you, thank you. Jimmy, what are we going to talk about this week?
So I thought we'd start off with this red-hot Sunday Times investigation into the happenings of Boris Johnson's government in the early, well, sort of pre-period of COVID-19 before we entered into the lockdown. I'm assuming you've read the news article in question, Jazza.
I have indeed, and I definitely paid for it.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, I haven't really studied out or memorised the details for this, but it basically says that government seriously took its eye off the ball during the weeks and months running up to the crisis, didn't order enough or secure enough medical equipment, including PPE and ventilators. Boris Johnson didn't attend all the meetings that he should have done, and generally the government's approach was pretty lackadaisical. Jazza, what's your immediate reaction to this news?
What I have enjoyed more than the actual article is the government's blow-by-blow response to
that,
the article.
That was good. Yeah, I was going to comment on that.
It's quite brilliant.
It's quite sassy in places, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the, like, clearly, I know the type of civil servant that would have written that. Like, it's, like, well done. I think you joked about the whole you can't begrudge a prime minister for wanting to take weekends. Part of me wants to be on board with you on that, but also I want Boris Johnson to hate being prime minister as much as possible, because I like the ironic tilt that would have for somebody who's clearly wanted to be prime minister for 20 years. Anyway,
it's poetry. I do agree.
It would be very poetic. Can I be real? I don't know enough about how governments are meant to respond to pandemics to know what is the appropriate thing to do. We talked extensively about East Asian democracies like Taiwan and South Korea and how they were able to respond to it really, really well. But that's because they've experienced it before, and Europe hasn't for a very, very long time had this kind of a pandemic. And so I can't be overly mad about the fact that they didn't really see it being so bad. No. I don't know. What do you think?
I was hoping you were going to come at this with some searing insights and, you know, well-studied out research, but I'm sort of in the same bracket as you, that I'm reading this blow-by-blow account, which is, you know, it's kind of amusing in a way, how, like, you know, the Sunday Times are slagging the government off and the government's just going, no, 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 no. I don't know. Yeah, as with you, I do kind of think it's acceptable for a government to have. Well, it's acceptable in the sense that this is kind of unprecedented for Europe. I mean, there's various things I've read that suggested we should have been better prepared, and I guess we'll go into that when we actually discuss this in full. But I suppose I'm in the same camp as you that I'm kind of sympathetic to a government that didn't necessarily see this coming, especially given some of the, people like the editor of The Lancet, which is a, leading medical journal, also was quite cautious in the early days of the pandemic developing as to whether it was going to be a serious problem. So speaking of people who are cautious about this pandemic, for the second topic, we are going to be discussing something that appeared on Unheard, which is a commentary site. It's from the UK.
What is Unheard? I had never heard of Unheard.
Oh, amazing.
Thank you.
It was started, if I remember correctly, by Tim Montgomery,
Oh, well, that explains
who's
all of
a
its content.
It, the thing is, it's one of those sites that branded itself as, we publish the things that nobody else is willing to publish. But I think in general, it's fair to say it has a centre-right tilt to it.
Yeah, they're not like doing interviews with people who believe that 5G causes coronavirus.
Yeah, that's true. And it's clearly not Navarra Media or anything like that. But I mean, I think it publishes some quite interesting stuff, and it has some good columnists. It I think he's the editor at large, I want to say, Freddie Sayers, who you found quite attractive. I think it's.
He's a oh, fuck you. He is a generic, like, Etonian looking blonde white man with a chin, and I hate myself for finding that attractive, but this is like I can't say no to, the biology that's happening inside me when I see him.
Amazing. I just wanted to bring it up because it was literally Jazz's first reaction to me when he started watching the video.
Yeah, Jimmy goes, "This is actually a really interesting interview." And I responded with, "The interviewer is hot."
His heart. Anyway, he spoke to Professor, I'm going to butcher this guy's name, Juhan Gisecki. I think it's
Johann Giesecke,
Gisecki.
I believe is how it should be pronounced.
Okay. We'll go with.
At me, Swedish fans.
We'll go with Jazz's pronunciation. Anyway, he's one of the Sweden's leading epidemiologists, and he was an advisor to the Swedish government. I think he just worked in a consulting capacity, so he's not. He's worked with the chief advisor to the Swedish government, or the chief medical officer. Getting the job titles wrong here. But he's fairly sceptical about the lockdowns that have been imposed throughout Europe. Partly because he thinks that it's really a matter of delaying the pandemic, and he also thinks that a lot of people in Sweden, the UK, and presumably other European countries have probably already had coronavirus and not really noticed it because they've been largely without symptoms. So I think it's fair to say he's a skeptic about the normal approach in Europe, the lockdown approach that Boris Johnson's government was eventually pressured into. Jazza, again, what were your initial thoughts on watching this guy?
He seems like the kind of person that would be interviewed on a website like Unheard.
Gonna leave that hanging until we actually get around to the topic, because I think people might know what you mean, but we'll get more into that in detail. You mentioned Boris Johnson likes to take weekends off, and I think one of the benefits
Oh,
we
this is
both
a bad link. No.
I wanted to make it earlier, but it didn't seem it wasn't the right time. But speaking of getting a good work-life balance, we are going to be discussing working from home, largely I think for a personal capacity. I don't think we.
I'll be completely honest with you, listener. This was put in the agenda by Jimmy, who basically just wants to bitch about all of the arcane traditions of working in an office that he usually has to adhere to, and how wonderful and freeing it is for him to be able to share a couple of cans of an afternoon with his live-in partner. So, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need any more introduction than that.
Yeah, we've talked about Taiwan quite a lot recently. I thought I'd give him this one.
Okay, I think that's fair enough. So, without further ado, we'll go to the begging for money section, and then we'll go into the podcast proper. podcast, mm-hmm. prodcast, oh. prodcast.
Oh, Jesus, just stop.
Just stop. All right, let's go. If you like what we do at the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. It's a pretty conventional Patreon account, and I'm fairly sure most of you know how that works. So if you're interested, head over there and do the business. We'd like to thank our existing patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O. Matt, and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support. Okay, are you recording?
I've been recording for the past 20 minutes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And none of my xenophobia has been recorded either. I think it was really good, actually.
You don't know I wasn't recording at my end about your hatred for the Swedish people.
My hatred of the Swedes. No, you know very well, just because of their dominance in the Eurovision, that I admire them more than I should.
Yeah, I can believe that.
See, it's so believable. It worked.
It's all about plausibility.
Speaking of plausibility.
Yes.
Well, no, the Times article, I think that was the most damaging thing about it, because you can 100% believe that Boris Johnson didn't do it.
You mean didn't have
his finger on the pulse, his eye on the ball. Yeah.
Other metaphors are available.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, well, this was one of my reactions to the article, is that I think it's been widely known that Johnson is, to put it in the most flattering way possible, not a details man. and is
what do you mean by that, Jimmy?
Well, even his stoutest defenders of his time as London mayor would say that he was a leader who delegated strongly, if you want to put it that way. He would find talented people in the generous telling of it, and he would let them get on with things, which I actually think is quite a good quality in a leader. But in a case like this, where you're having a crisis, it's probably not an ideal quality, I don't think. You probably want someone who is a details man, who's going to stick on top of the brief.
Do you think we would have, because quite interestingly, that is pretty much exactly, it describes quite acutely the Theresa May style of government, where she yes. was on top of everything a lot more. Do you think that we would have preferred somebody like Theresa May in this kind of situation?
Well, I think what Theresa May got wrong was generally the politics of things. I don't know that she necessarily got the details wrong. There didn't seem to be a suggestion that she was ignorant about the ins and outs of policy. It was just she was bad at negotiating, not only with the EU, but with her own party. And obviously there was what turned out to be the disastrous election call, and then she really just didn't have the numbers in Parliament in order to do what she wanted to do. Those are significant failings for a Prime Minister, but they're not necessarily failings that are associated with a lack of knowledge of the brief. I don't know how you would feel about this, but I think purely, even knowing what I know now about Theresa May, I would prefer her to be in charge during the course of a serious pandemic than Boris Johnson.
I almost wish that we'd kind of like flipped the two. Maybe if Boris Johnson had kind of taken us out of the EU, and then Theresa May, if we could just kind of like switch their times as Prime Minister, that would be great. Thank you. It was one of Theresa May's qualities that they always used to big up, especially in the run up to the 2017 election. This kind of fact, it was Theresa May and her team. She was very much the person who was over the top of every brief. She was talked about in that capacity by a lot of people who worked with her when she was Home Secretary. To be fair, we can't really begrudge Boris very much because he's had coronavirus and has been in intensive care and been sick. But even before he was taken seriously ill, he did seem to delegate an awful lot of his time at those kind of press conferences and all of those kinds of things. But maybe I'm being too analytical of that. I'm not sure.
Maybe. I mean, one of the allegations laid out in this piece is that Boris Johnson didn't chair COBRA meetings, which are kind of emergency government meetings for any kind of crisis. He actually left it to, I think it was generally Matt Hancock, who's the health
Well,
secretary.
yeah, because of the health, but that makes sense. The co so I knew this before the government did a blow by blow, kind of like breakdown of the Times's kind of like smack piece is what I automatically want to call it.
Well, I think hit piece is the term of art,
Hit
although I think
piece.
that might be a little. I don't know if that's unfair. I mean, I don't really detect that. I don't really detect that the Sunday Times is in general ill-disposed to Boris Johnson. So I
It
think.
was set. It was certainly an ungenerous portrayal of him and the government. But COBRA meetings, more often than not, do not have the Prime Minister there. Like they are, just like it's literally the name of a room. It's not. It's not like going down to a bunker with the president in it.
Sorry, I was just pouring a drink. And then
Sorry.
you stop sooner than I expected.
I should have talked for longer.
It's not usually a problem for you. Speaking with the same sass as that government put down. I mean, I think that is true that, you know, it's intuitive that you would have the you know, the relevant secretary leading a meet, you know, a COBRA meeting. But I think it's also true that during times of crisis, people want the prime minister to be on top of things, and he is, you know, supposed to be the boss at the end of the day. And as you say, there is just a general plausibility that Boris Johnson wasn't really devoting his full attention to, to the pandemic. But I mean, some of that is because he was off dealing with things like Brexit. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine now. Back on Brexit Day, the 1st of January, I don't think any of us were paying attention to, you know, this pandemic that was flaring up in China at that time.
And I'm not sure you would necessarily expect the Prime Minister to be at the COBRA meeting about a pandemic that was happening in East Asia. And as far as we knew, it was just going to be another SARS or another bird flu, for example, that though they occasionally did cross over into European countries, they were much less potent and didn't travel nearly as well, partially because their rates of death were so much higher, so it was a lot easier to kind of like track those. I believe only SARS was a coronavirus, actually, not bird flu. But what did you? I'm curious what you thought of kind of like the journalism as the journalist, Jimmy. What do you think of the journalism that the Times released on Sunday?
There was some on the record criticism in the Times piece, from you know, various kind of academics and people with medical expertise. But the main thrust of the article did seem to hinge on one particular. It was variously phrased as a senior advisor to Downing Street and as a senior Downing Street advisor, which I think the government in its rebuttal fairly pointed out means slightly different things. Although that could just be sloppy writing rather than referring to two different people.
That could be an editor not understanding the difference between those two things, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think generously you'd say they're obviously the same person, but it's not entirely clear whether this is somebody who's working on the fringes of government or who's working within government. I mean, there seem to be some kind of details that, if you believe the government's response, that the piece just got wrong. Although I think that's quite normal in an investigation of this kind to actually get certain details wrong, just in terms of timing and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that the gist of the government's rebuttal is really that a lot of this is almost like hindsight bias. It's like saying, oh, obviously the response was inadequate given what we know now, but you know.
Like for example, one of the ones that really stood out for me was the fact that we donated 12,000 units of personal protective equipment, PPE, to China when it was going through the COVID outbreak itself. I think even before we'd called it COVID. And like at the time, obviously you should do that because we didn't have any cases yet.
But also, it's in your narrow self-interest in the sense that the more it's contained in the country of origin, the less of a risk it poses to your country.
Yeah. And I don't presumably. Know. I like. I think just because I loved the tone of the government, the government response. I don't know. I probably side a little bit more with the government on this than I do with the journalism. I think this possibly was a journalist who got carried away with a source or a couple of sources.
Well, it was the Insight team, which is several journalists.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of hard.
Who are the Insights team? Actually, I don't know who they are.
I'd have to look it up on the article.
I don't not names, but like, what's their job at the Times?
So the Insight team was kind of my understanding. It was sort of years and years ago under people like Harold Evans, who's sort of one of the great Sunday Times editors, were the sort of team. It was the team that actually uncovered stuff like the pregnancy drug that caused birth defects.
I know the one you mean. I don't know the name.
Yeah,
but
the name is escaping me. And there was also, effectively, it was a team that just did really great investigative journalism and actually sometimes ended up in sort of wrongdoers being prosecuted or having court cases raised against them. And so it was one of kind of the hallmarks of Harold Evans' editorship. And it sustained itself for a while, but I think it fell away and it was resurrected within the last decade. So it's kind of the specialist investigative journalism unit within the Times. Although, you know, this particular article actually kind of is a bit more similar to the sort of thing that Tim Shipman, the Sunday Times political editor, would normally do.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if he's actually bylined on the piece. I don't think he is.
But it reminded me a little bit of the kind of stuff that Carol Cadwalder was given the byline for in the investigations around the Brexit referendum,
right?
Like in terms of tone, it felt reverse engineered to me.
In what sense?
In that it felt like the conclusion had already been made that the government response was insufficient, and it worked backwards from that, and so found every single possible thing that could make that argument. Kind of like how a lawyer would make a case in a courtroom. And that always sits badly with me, maybe because I'm like an academic and academics have kind of like integrity in a way that journalists don't. But there wasn't kind of like this, we found a thing and then we unpacked what this means. Am I making sense?
You're making sense. I mean, I think the trouble with the Carol Cadwalader kind of school of journalism is, to my mind anyway, is that she throws out accusations and then finds the evidence to back it up, which is maybe a bridge version of what you were saying there.
Yeah, so I maybe wouldn't be so ungenerous to Carol Cadwalder as that, but it's a similar thing of, this is the conclusion that I want to prove, how do I go about proving this conclusion? And it felt like, again and again, with some of the pettiness in the Times piece, that it was trying to find everything possible that it could use to prove that the government had not acted correctly in its response, in its early response to COVID-19.
I think the other thing is, you would expect some fairly significant mistakes in any government's handling of a situation like this, I think. Just because of the unknowns involved in the nature of the pandemic itself, kind of comparing yourself to different countries as well, the political ramifications, it's very unlikely that any government would have emerged entirely unscathed out of a crisis like this, I think.
Mm-hmm. What was your take on the tone of the journalism? Did you have kind of like a similar vibe, or what was your take on it before you read the rebuttal from the government?
Well, to be honest with you, I read the rebuttal before I read the original piece, which is potentially not the way you should go about it. But, I mean, it seems to me that it's quite difficult to judge a lot of the claims as an outsider because, you know, from our point of view, it's almost a he said, she said situation in which, you know, mm-hmm. you have the Times saying, well, this happened, and then you have the government going, well, no, this is what actually happened. And then it kind of becomes a matter of, well, who do you trust in that scenario? I wouldn't expect the government to lie, but the government will obviously be flattering about itself.
I wouldn't say that it was... There wasn't so much a conflict of facts, but there was a conflict of what those facts meant. So, for example, the Prime Minister not attending certain COBRA meetings wasn't said to be not true, but it was said that it is normal for the Prime Minister to not attend every single COBRA meeting, for example. There was a clarification on the units of PPE being sent to China and the fact that China has responded to that and given us many times over the same amount of the same type of protective equipment. There wasn't so much these facts are wrong, but there was the facts that you have do not mean what you think they mean.
That is actually a fair. I mean, there's an interesting thing around sort of the comparison to the Spanish flu, which the Times uses to suggest that actually the government should have been alarmed from very early on, and the government says, well, actually, the way you've actually used that comparison is inaccurate. So that would be one example of what you're talking about. I suppose this is actually, in some ways, it's quite a good case study for the difficulties of, the difficulties of objective journalism, in the sense that, yes, you can, if you're lucky, you can agree on what the facts are, but you won't necessarily agree on what those facts mean.
Oh, that's so deep.
Is it deep? I feel it's sort of obvious, really.
Okay.
I know you're being sarcastic, but I don't know. It does generally feel that the reporting that's come out that the government was a bit slow to react, but then you do have that mitigating factor of it.
I feel like we already have the answer as to why they were slow to react. They were slow to react because they didn't believe that a lockdown would be politically possible in the United Kingdom. That's the vibe that I've heard and gotten.
So that there was a Reuters report from a little while back, which said that one of the groups of scientists advising the government, and there are at least two different committees who are advising the government for reasons I'm not entirely sure about, but one of them...
It's normal to have a red team and a blue team, I think, is it not, in these kinds of scenarios?
Possibly. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's what the role that these two committees play. I'm talking about, one of them is called SAGE, and I can't remember the acronym of the other one. It's something quite cumbersome. There was one team of scientists that would have advised a lockdown, but they thought it wasn't politically possible. I suppose that's quite interesting, because it's not scientists' job to think about what's politically possible. It should be scientists' jobs just to say, you know, this is what we think the risk is. Here is what we think some measures will achieve.
Here are your options, right? Exactly.
But that
would segue quite nicely into our next topic, if you so wish.
It would do, yeah. So I actually thought one of the... we'll get into some of the more medical claims that... I forgot how to pronounce his name. It's
Johan Giesecke.
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 That's a bit more Spanish, isn't it?
Giesecke sounds like an Italian liqueur.
It does do, yeah, it does. I'm just going to... During this interview on Unheard, it starts off with a lot of discussions just about the medical ramifications, and this guy's well qualified to talk about that. Mm-hmm. It then kind of diverts into more political speculation, which I'd imagine is the part that you have a greater problem with, because it's the part I have a problem with. In the sense that one of the things he says is that he doesn't think in a democracy the lockdown will be viable in the long term. I mean, interested in your impression of this, but my impression is actually the lockdown has a great deal of public support. I think that what the question of when it ends is as much about whether the government thinks it can afford it in the long term.
Obviously, I respect this guy. He's clearly a clever, really clever man. But he's obviously, his responses in this interview were obviously influenced and led by his own political opinions. And there were several moments throughout the interview where and thank God for long form interviews, actually, where that seeped through, kind of like his ideology that was kind of informing some of the decisions that he was making medically. A lot of the times I was actually very surprised to kind of like medically and scientifically how he was so ready to be sure about some of the potential stats that he was pontificating about. Like, for example, the fact that he would expect that once we have a test that shows whether or not somebody has had COVID-19. He would expect around 50% of the population to have had it, but had mild to no symptoms.
So that's in the UK and Sweden, he says specifically, but presumably it would apply to most of Europe.
Yeah, but you'd assume like across other parts of Europe as well that have had similar exposures and experiences with the disease. And I did not understand why he believed that was so high. Maybe it was just the fault of the interviewer for not talking about it. He also talks... And this was a weird, maybe it was just like an old white man thing, but he talked about the fact that he thought that maybe the fact that deaths in care homes were higher in Sweden because there are so many asylum seekers who work in the care sector in Sweden and their Swedish isn't as good, so maybe it took longer for them to understand government guidance. Which is an odd thing to think.
I think you've misunderstood. You've sort of conflated 2 points.
Okay, go on. Set me right, because that's how I understood it.
So he compared the care system, sort of deaths in the care system due to COVID-19 in Sweden versus Norway. And one of the points he made was that, or one of the factors that he thought was influential in that is that Sweden generally has larger care homes, i.e., care homes with more patients in than Norway. And therefore, if somebody gets COVID-19 in a Swedish care home, the exposure is going to more people are going to be exposed, basically. So that was one of the factors he thought was influential. Bearing in mind that I think Norway has a more conventional lockdown, more restrictive measures in general against the coronavirus. The point he made about refugees is, I think he criticised the Swedish government for not protecting care homes more thoroughly in the early days, and he thought that one of the reasons why the restrictions hadn't been implemented as successfully as they could have been was because I don't know why he talked about refugees and asylum systems. It was asylum seekers. It was a bit gammon. I assume what he meant in the more challenging.
Did you say that it was a bit gammon?
It was a bit gammon. Is that not fair?
I love that. No, continue, please. Go on.
I assume what he meant, if we're casting it in a generous light.
No, but that's what I was trying to articulate. I understood the two different things.
Yeah, they were slightly different points of the interview, but I assume what he meant was that it's mostly significantly immigrants working in people who do not have Swedish as their native language who work in care homes, which, if it's anything like the UK, I suspect is probably true. Whether that's a big factor in terms of imposing restrictions around care homes, I don't know. It seems like it would be a factor, but it seems unlikely to me that it would be.
It seems unlikely. I'm sorry. It seems really unlikely to be kind of a defining factor in the spread of COVID-19. Frankly. Also another time when the mask slipped was when he talked about how a lockdown would not be politically viable. And he also has with the social science says that is not the case. Actually, there is a huge amount, at least in the UK, there's a huge amount of support for a lockdown, at least for now.
Well, the interviewer who you fancy, just thought I'd mention that again.
Fantastic jaw. I mean, oof.
did push back on that, to be fair. I think he was a little bit sceptical about that, but I mean, I think this is good. You know, this is good. I don't want to turn every single segment in this podcast into a learning opportunity, but it's worth noting that experts are experts generally in one thing, and this guy is an expert in epidemiology. He's not really an expert in anything else necessarily, or certainly not anything else that's, you know, not related to that. I think it's fair to say, because I thought his the interview, which is about half an hour, the early stage was more about the medical stuff. Which I think he was much more convincing on. The second stage was more like political speculation.
And he doesn't know anything about how South Korea are dealing with COVID-19. Like, as an example, like it's really enjoyable when you get to the point where you hear people talk about stuff that you actually know some stuff about, and they don't know what they're talking about.
So remind me what he said about South Korea in particular.
He was talking about the fact that policies were no longer working and that cases were increasing, but they have plateaued at like, um, I actually don't know if South Korea has had any new native cases for a while, actually. I can double check. But he said, he just said something that was completely untrue around South Korea. So there are 13 new cases, and I think those 13 cases are all from abroad, but I'm not 100% sure.
Wasn't his wider point in relation to South Korea, and I think he also mentioned Singapore,
that actually, and Taiwan as well.
He mentioned Taiwan in passing, is that they've probably not prevented coronavirus in the long term, and they've probably only delayed it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you buy, I guess?
That is the whole point of lockdown. The whole point of lockdown, as I understand it anyway, is not to stop it from spreading, because that is almost inevitable and next to impossible to do, because you would still need to quarantine places like South Korea and Taiwan in the globally connected world that we have some form of lockdown, even if that is the checking of temperatures of people getting off flights, for example, will have to exist until there's a vaccine. And you're just postponing until then, essentially, until you have actually the resources and the capability of being able to deal with having more and more sick people. That's why you have this lockdown. And that seemed to be something that was missing.
Well, he seemed fairly pessimistic about the prospects for a vaccine as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, maybe. But we don't know, actually. There's never been a global force movement like this that is so focused on kind of like, I mean, if only we'd had this for AIDS, eh? Would have been nice, thanks to the 1980s.
I mean, we haven't actually talked about his, we've sort of touched on it, his general thesis that actually the Swedish model of not imposing so many restrictions, so they've, schools are still open in Sweden, they still have restaurants open, they've had some social distancing measures put in place, and as kind of indicated before, they've also put protections around kind of care homes and that sort of thing, so they're kind of targeted towards protecting the vulnerable. Sort of the elderly, the frail, and so on. And he thinks he seems to think that's a more proportionate response than what much of Europe has done, which is impose a more full-scale lockdown with restaurants and pubs shut. And, mm-hmm. you know, in France, they obviously have the system where you need a permit to leave the house.
Yeah, and in Spain as well. I think there are actually cultural aspects to this. You try and get Spaniards to not go out to the bar downstairs and have a few pints of an evening.
That about British people, didn't they?
Yes, which is why I think that we're somewhere in between the two in terms of restrictions. I think that there are cultural things. There are perhaps, I don't know enough about Sweden. I've never been. I've met Swedish people before. I like them. They're lovely people. There are perhaps other cultural aspects here of Swedes being more, perhaps more cautious, more likely to adhere to guidelines rather than rules.
Well, this is kind of a stereotype, and it's always risky touching on these kind of things with Jazza in the room. But
hey, it's me touching on the Swedes, and.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the stereotype is that Northern Europeans, particularly the more Germanic peoples, let's say, are more mm-hmm. inclined to follow rules than, say, you know, the Mediterraneans.
Then the Hispanics and the Latins who just want to feel things, you know.
Yeah, the passionate Italians and Spaniards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's probably some truth in that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's all the bad coffee.
All the bad coffee. Do Spain and Italy have particularly bad coffee?
Italy's coffee tends to be quite good. Spain's coffee is atrocious, but not as bad as France.
Interesting tonight.
Good, just so you know, in case you ever leave the house again.
For what it's worth, I was in Sweden recently, and the coffee was fine. So
yeah, but you have bad taste.
I mean, I have very expensive taste, he says, sipping his craft beer.
Oh, for goodness sake. All right, Jimmy, how have you felt working from home? How early have you been cracking out the craft beer every night?
I've actually been pretty restrained, partly because this stuff is pretty expensive. Not bragging, but you know, I don't want to go bankrupt during this dangerous time.
Not bragging, but I've got a disposable income.
I don't know if you found this as well, but I've saved so much money during this lockdown, which clearly means that I spend it on shit most of the time.
I invested quite a lot up front on a home office and a nice chair, so I am still hand to mouth, which is fun.
Wow. I mean, the chair is probably a good shout, because I have noticed some back problems developing.
So it cost me £150, and it's the best £150 I've ever spent, ever.
I can well believe that. So obviously, you know, sort of seeing from the general lockdown thesis of last topic, mm-hmm. We know that we're going to be 3 more weeks in the UK of being in lockdown, and probably more than that realistically, but they've said 3 weeks until it comes up for a review again, where they might ease restrictions. I think, you know, realistically, we've got a couple more months of white collar workers largely working from home.
I'm going to be locked down until autumn easily.
Yeah,
easily. The company I work is definitely going to be one of the last ones to kind of like let people back in the office, and I have just accepted that.
Well, some people, there's been sort of, when this lockdown was originally started, there was a flurry of articles around home working and whether the coronavirus would actually change things and whether more companies would decide that their employees could work from home. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of that, actually?
It is, so as somebody who has worked completely remotely for, as well as had office jobs, I will be completely honest, it depends on the job. If I have a job that is demanding, I completely have to work as if I have a 9-to-5 and my well-being is worse, and I have to be more conscious about where my workspace is and when I clock off, like doing exercise so that my brain has a chance to shut off and all of those kinds of things. If I have a job that is frankly very easy and that I can do with the TV on, then I will play video games all day. That's my personal experience from it. But generally, people who work from home, quote unquote, tend to work more days, I believe. They also tend to struggle with work-life balance and have to take days off for mental health and things like that. I will say this experiment that we are living through is still an experiment. We actually don't know what productivity for these particular parts of the economy are going to what the results are going to yield after this experiment. It will be interesting.
I think, as you kind of indicated there, it is going to depend company by company and probably person by person. I suppose, well, we discussed this a little bit before we started recording. It does seem a little, you know, notwithstanding that some people do struggle to work from home, it does seem kind of unintuitive that we obviously, as this pandemic has proved, have the means for many of us to work from home, as in most of us have the technology already there, you know, bar mm-hmm. maybe an office chair that we need to throw £150 at.
It was a choice. I chose the one with the lower lumbar support for an extra 20.
Wow, fancy. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, just sweet.
You could have spent that on 4 craft beers.
Jesus, it's very... Jesus. £5 for a beer, Jimmy?
I wonder, you know, emulate the pub experience without actually going to the pub.
Even a pub in London, it won't be that expensive. What is wrong with you?
What pubs are you going to that you can get a pint for less than £5?
Leighton.
Okay. So anyway, got diverted there. You know, my experience of working from home is that it has been pretty much better. Don't have to commute, so don't spend that time commuting. Don't spend the money on commuting as well. Working from home is better than working in an open plan office in terms of distractions. I suppose it depends on your temperament and also
that is
the thing.
I am definitely much more productive and less distracted by a overstimulant office environment, overstimulating office environment. And commutes are the worst part of my day. Like, I'm really lucky. I only have a 15-minute commute when my office is open. And that was one of the main reasons why I decided to have this job.
You joke, but it makes a big difference, I think.
It's changed my life. If I need to pop home for something at lunch, I can pop home for something anyway. Now I'm just pining for a time when I had to go somewhere every day.
And I think my point was, it is kind of unintuitive that we're making people, even in London, I think the average commute is still like 45 minutes or something.
Oh, which is an insane. That's so much of your life.
Yeah. But that's partly just because of how London's structured, with all the business stuff is kind of in the centre of town. And then the suburb, I mean, but a lot of the suburbs were built as dormitory towns to house commuters, basically.
Calling them a dormitory town is just depressing.
That's a term of art, actually. It's not something I just made up.
Yeah, but it is depressing.
I think that there's a lot of reasons why managers are reluctant to let employees work from home. The main reason that seems to come up is that they're suspicious that they will just play video games like Jazza.
Yeah, but if I am hitting all of my targets, then why does it matter?
Well, that's the other argument, really, isn't it? That it's, why do you need to work a set number of hours if what your employers really want from you is not time on the clock? It's probably stuff done, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was stopping remote working being more commonplace?
Well,
before this crisis, obviously.
So there is kind of a bit. I think it is that reluctance in terms of overseeing employees and the belief that actually people would just DOS. And I think one of the things that this pandemic will actually will change is that managers with experience of managing employees remotely now will probably not be able to say that, because I think probably most people are still working roughly at the same rate. The other argument, and this is actually something that comes up all the time in office design, is that innovation happens better when employees are in the same room and sort of bump into each other more. So like in kind of the big Silicon Valley companies, whenever they design offices, they always place an emphasis on creating these spontaneous reactions. I think it's part of the thinking behind open plan offices as well. And that boosts more innovation in theory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm pretty skeptical about that. I mean, just from personal experience of using an office, I don't feel that I've become particularly innovative just because I'm sat roughly in the same, you know, space as somebody else.
I, as like a massive extrovert, I really miss all of that, actually. Like that, the office banter, the building of relationships with people and all of those kind of things. And I think it is an important part of being an effective worker, especially when you work in kind of like perhaps a larger, maybe even in a smaller company, actually. That building of camaraderie, I think, is very, is key to being as efficient as possible. But having the option to work remotely or from home as much as possible, it just makes sense to me. Mm. And it makes no sense for the technology. Like I don't think I've ever had a job that I, no, that's a lie. I did lots of manual labor when I was younger. Anyway, carry on.
Well, this guy, I mean, I do take the point that particularly for extroverts, they do feed off other people's energy. And I can totally see why for some people working from home actually sounds like a nightmare. And there's probably a lot of people not really enjoying the,
Do you know what I'm doing in order to combat this?
Go on.
Like, literally every 2 hours I have a coffee date
with different people.
Yeah.
Like, you mean by coffee date you mean actual romantic dating, or you mean...
No, you numpty. Jesus Christ. No, like a coffee, like, let's go for a coffee, like we're going to the kitchen and we're grabbing a cup of tea or something. Like the equivalent of that, but we'll sit down, we'll have a little bit of a chin wag for 10 minutes, and then we'll go off and do our thing.
Yeah.
I've been doing that loads.
Well, I was going to say, actually, the kind of advocates of home working often say that you sometimes need to replace those kind of interactions you'd get at the office through things like video conferencing and that kind of thing, which is probably still not as good as the real thing, but is better than nothing, I'm sure you're finding.
Yeah, 100%. It's very different because there isn't kind of, as you said, the serendipitous nature of bumping into somebody that you will often get in an office especially. But it's still nice to have those interactions. I will say I'm exhausted by the fact that every time I interact with somebody, it is for a purpose. Even when it's with friends of a Friday evening and we're doing a pub quiz, I have to have done preparation for 20 questions on Theresa May, and it's just exhausting.
Yeah, but one aspect of the lockdown I'm definitely not enjoying is the fact that all kind of social interactions are done via webcam and that
sort planned
of
yeah.
Or planned. But, I mean, don't you find, kind of, at this stage of your life, that actually your life is fairly planned, as it were?
No, I thrive in chaos.
Oh. Well, that certainly explains our podcast scheduling, then.
I should have never gotten a mortgage, Jimmy. I'm not the kind of person that deals well with it.
I mean, I think one thing is actually that I think many companies will actually just order their workers straight back to the office. Is that apart from anything else, there's the upfront investment in real estate. That you know, there's.
But maybe this means that real estate is going to crash because people are going to realise that it's fucking useless.
Which,
as someone with a mortgage,
I mean,
would be a bad thing.
You wouldn't, but based on the last, you know, the post-war years in Britain, I don't think you'd bet against the real estate market.
That's a fair point.
Just on historical record alone. But I also think that a lot of the costs of working in an office are actually borne by the workers rather than by the company itself.
So, how do you mean?
Well, in terms of, I can say if I work from home, it's great for me because I save 10 hours a week that would be spent commuting, but my company doesn't care because that's not their time. If you see what I mean, and equally that, you know, the amount I have to pay to do that as well, again, not a cost borne by the company. The upside for them is obviously they could reduce their amount of office space that they have to rent out, and then they would make savings. But I think that really depends on the company and whether they're willing or even able to do that.
Well, you know, no, but it is it's the future. I don't know if it's necessarily inevitable, but it is the future of a large number of companies, especially startups that work maybe not completely remotely, but it is at least encouraged or an option.
Yeah.
And especially with the crime. I hate that it gets called the gig economy because it makes it sound cool, yeah. But the contingent work that is now defining of so many careers of graphic designers, of video editors, of project managers even, all of those are kind of like things that don't require an office necessarily, and are maybe they are on site, or maybe they are somebody has sent you a couple of reference files and you have to rustle something up for them. Like, all of those are characteristics that define kind of like millennial work at the moment, and so it was definitely going in this direction anyway, and so there will possibly be a lot more new companies in the future that have experienced this and know that the investment in real estate is not something that they necessarily need.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, maybe this is my cynical interpretation, but I think there will be more demand to work from home, and there will obviously be a lot of examples where people have proven they can do it. But I think I just feel cynically that a lot of companies will just think like, well, you know, once restrictions are lifted, we'll just get people back in the office. Because I mean, I think it's been kind of obvious that people could work from home for a while, depending on the nature of the job. But, you know, a lot of people have computers at home, personal computers that are more powerful than the computers they use at work, for instance. So it obviously can be done.
100%. I'm with you.
But I don't think, I don't know. I guess we'll see how this all pans out. But on a personal level, I guess I'm hopeful it will. But cynically, it will as well.
I am so surprised that you're not able to. And that for most journalists, that is not the case, because yours is probably the least contingent on being in an office. And actually, you could argue that being in an office is negative to your productivity, perhaps.
It's kind of weird because journalism.
But then what do I know?
Journalism is one of those whenever I've gone for a job interview anyway, and you say, how much time do you spend in the office? And they say, oh, well, we try and spend as much time out of the office as possible. It's a cliche that companies never live up to. But yeah, I think there are certain jobs where it doesn't really make any sense to. I mean, maybe it makes sense to have an office that people can go to on occasion for certain things, but it probably doesn't make sense to have everyone working
maybe,
there all the time.
Maybe one that you can break into at like 3 a.m. and after a rough night at the club and sleep it off before the first train home.
Or the first news conference, as the case may be.
Ayo.
But yeah, I think I don't know. I think it's a good thing that will probably not happen. So that's my cynical interpretation, because we've had the tools for a while. So unless this inculcates a mass cultural shift,
yeah. If this weren't going to change it, then nothing will.
I will say like one other thing that we might be worth discussing before we wrap this up is that actually, even though we're talking about this as you know privileged millennials who don't have any real commitments, no offense, Jazza.
That's rude.
For a lot of people, like if you're talking about like making work more inclusive for you know people with families or people who might physically struggle to get into an office, working from home also makes sense. And it also might make the economy less centered on big city centers, because if people can work from anywhere, there's less
and
incentive
on and
for
on
them to...
and on specific cities, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
The ability to move to Bristol but still work for a big multinational in London. Could be a really attractive option. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that a big Californian company can't make that happen.
Oh, mate, don't even. I've had many conversations.
Many fruitful conversations.
No fruit, just mush.
On you know, mentioning fruitful conversations, it's probably time that we wrap this up. Jazza,
we wrap up this particular fruitful conversation. You can find me, you were about to ask, I'm at Jazza John on all social platforms because I'm a good internet boy.
You can find me at JDE Nichols only on Twitter because I'm not a good internet boy.
Terrible internet boy.
Yeah, it's bad.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're done now.
We are done. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Bye.